will call this meeting of the Labor Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is March, or February 7th. Get my month too far ahead. Anyway, the clerk will note the roll. First thing on our agenda is the minutes. And Representative Jordan, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move their approval.
Motion's been made to approve the minutes from February 2nd, Groundhog's Day, 2023. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
15.
The ayes have it. The minutes are approved. Members, we have a lot of testifiers today, and we have one bill on the agenda. And Representative Richardson, if you want to come to the table, hopefully we can get through this. We will be voting on this before the end of committee. So, testifiers, keep your remarks short to allow us to have a chance to discuss the bill. And with that, welcome to the committee, Representative. And please, I'll move the House File 2 to be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also have an author's amendment, the A21.
I'll move the A21, the author's amendment, to put it in the shape that the author would like. And you want to briefly explain the A21, what it is?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So the A21 would add some clarifying language to the provision prohibiting employers from retaliating against workers seeking paid family medical leave benefits. In addition to preventing retaliation, it would also prohibit employers from discharging, disciplining, penalizing, interfering with, coercing, or discriminating against a worker seeking to use the leave benefits.
Thank you, members. Any questions on the amendment? Seeing no hands going up, again, I move the A21 amendment. All in favor to put the bill in the shape the author wants, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. Motion's approved. Explain your bill, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2, as amended, creates a statewide family and medical leave benefit program and would provide a much-needed safety net for families who need to take time away from work to care for a new child or care for a sick family member or to recover themselves. As the committee's jurisdiction is limited to the enforcement provisions of the Department of Labor and Industry, I'll keep my remarks limited to the committee's jurisdiction. Before we do a brief walkthrough of the relevant provisions, I wanted to share just a little bit of background on the fact that a number of the components of the bill have been modeled after a long-standing unemployment insurance program. So how the department would interact with other agencies is often similar to current practice under the UI program. Today I have with me Ms. Deborah Fitzpatrick, who will do a brief walkthrough of the relevant provisions under the committee's jurisdiction.
Thank you. And if you want to identify yourself for the record, and then you can proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick, and I'm the Director of Policy and Research at Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota. In my prior role at the University of Minnesota, I led the research team that conducted Minnesota's legislatively mandated design and implementation study under contract with DEED. I'll spend just a few minutes grounding the committee in the overall program structure at a high level and then pull back to the parts related to DLI's jurisdiction. So House File 2 sets up a statewide publicly administered insurance program that is self-funded and sustainable over the long term through contributions from workers and employers, and it allows self-employed people and business owners to join the program and employers to provide their own comparable program. Eligibility is based on workforce participation, and healthcare providers certify the need and the length of leave for most leaves. Much of the program, as Representative Richardson mentioned, is builds on Minnesota's successful UI processes, as well as those in eight other states with implemented programs. Among the design options, this one was chosen for a variety of reasons. I'll lift up just three right now. First, it is a portable wage replacement benefit, especially important for workers with multiple employers or those changing jobs. Second, it creates the broadest possible risk pool a feature necessary for keeping costs low and leveling the playing field among employers. And finally, it is the proven, effective, sustainable model that gives all workers an opportunity to earn and count on the benefit from year to year and makes costs currently borne by both employers and workers more predictable. While the bill provides up to 12 weeks of medical and 12 weeks for family leave for serious life events lasting more than 7 days, experience shows that workers take what they need, and that is on average less than the maximum allowed. For example, Massachusetts allows up to 26 weeks, and median leave lengths have been 12. In Washington, the entitlement is 12 to 18 weeks, and the average has been around 7. There is no evidence that Minnesota workers are less committed to their employers or their coworkers, or more inclined to abuse their benefits than those in other states. In fact, one could argue the opposite. Furthermore, the design of House File 2 sits squarely within the parameters of other states, with not a single major policy element that isn't matched or exceeded by other state programs. And since we have been talking about leave lengths, I will just note that 5 other states have combined leave entitlements that exceed those in House File 2. So House File 2 includes 2 related components: wage replacement, as we had just talked about, and employment protected leave, with slightly different eligibility requirements. Wage replacement requires an earning history and an eligible event, whereas the employment protections require that as a basis, you're eligible for the wage replacement, plus 90 days with the employer. Finally, I just wanted to lift up to some other important aspects of employment protections in House File 2. First of all, House File 2 leave entitlements run concurrently with those under Minnesota's unpaid pregnancy and parenting leave law, as well as the federal FMLA. These entitlements are not stackable. Second, enforcement of employment protections mirror those included in FMLA. And finally, just to wrap up, enforcement of employment protections falls to DLI under the bill, and conciliation services are offered to resolve disputes outside the court system. So with that, I'll be available for questions later.
Thank you. First testifier I have on my list here is Nicole Blissenbach, Commissioner of Labor and Industry. Welcome to the Representative McDonald, you said you have your hand up for a question, or?
The reason I have my hand question is I'm looking for a fiscal note on this bill. This bill has been through numerous committees, Mr. Chair, and we still have not seen a fiscal note. This will be a very, very large bill, very costly. I think I've seen some estimates from the last year, and I think it's completely irresponsible for the bill author to bring a bill to this committee without any fiscal note. Now, I've been here for 13 years, and when I first started, the fiscal notes didn't really understand them completely. But after 13 years, I say it was very important. I would never put my colleagues, or you for that matter, in a position to vote for a bill of this magnitude with no fiscal note whatsoever. I think it is the height of irresponsibility to not to present that to this committee or any committee. And I wouldn't ever expect you to vote on any bill of mine without a fiscal note. So therefore, I move to table this bill until we have a fiscal note.
Motion's been made to table the bill. And Representative McDonald, let me just say that this bill still has many other fiscal committees that has to go to. And my understanding is our piece of it is a very small piece of that fiscal note. So as this is moving on, before it gets to or gets out of Ways and Means, there will be a fiscal note for the bill, or it won't go anywhere. Right now, we're trying to deal with the policy pieces of this. But you made a motion to table the bill, so members.
And I ask for a roll call, Mr.
And he asked for a roll call.
Chair Nelson?
No.
Nelson, nay. Vice Chair Berg?
No.
Berg, nay. Lead McDonald?
Yes.
McDonald, aye. Representative Daniels?
Aye.
Daniels, aye. Representative Greenman?
No.
Greenman, nay. Representative Hill?
No.
Hill, nay. Representative Hussein is excused. Representative Jordan?
No.
Jordan, nay. Representative Kozlowski?
No.
Kozlowski, nay. Representative Mecklund? Excuse. Representative Myers?
Aye.
Myers, aye. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott? Excused. Mr. Chair, with the conclusion of roll call, there are 4 ayes and 6 nays.
With 4 ayes and 6 nays, the motion is defeated. Can we proceed within our testifiers? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Nelson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Blissenbach, and I'm the commissioner with the Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 2. Most employees will need family and medical leave at some point during their career, but approximately 26% of all family and medical leaves do not include any wage replacement at all. All too often, this leads to workers having to choose between their financial stability and the ability to take leave to care for their own health, the health of a family member, or for bonding and parental leave. Access to paid family and medical leave is highly inequitable. While many Minnesotan workers received some pay when they were out of work for family or medical reasons, data shows that low-wage workers, African-American workers, Hispanic workers, younger workers, and part-time workers are much more likely to manage leaves without any pay. This proposal is a research-supported approach to address these inequities. Similar programs in other states have shown improvements in economic stability for families and positive impacts for children. Societal benefits include removing barriers for women to remain in the labor force, reductions in the need and associated costs for nursing home and other institutional care, reductions in the need for public assistance when a new baby arrives, and less infant care shortages. Without a comprehensive state paid family and medical leave program, Minnesotans are missing out on the economic stability and economy boosting effects of keeping people employed while welcoming a new family member, caring for a sick loved one, or recovering from an illness or injury. I want to specifically address the aspects of this bill that are under DLI's jurisdiction and therefore fall under the purview of this committee. Anytime a program offers a benefit to employees, it's necessary to also provide protections to employees as they access and use those benefits. It's often said that a right without a remedy is not really a right. The protections in this bill include a prohibition on retaliation and interference, access to continued insurance, the right to reinstatement after a leave. These protections fall under the jurisdiction of the Department of Labor and Industry and help ensure that employees will be able to fully realize the benefits of this important program. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today and to voice strong support of the administration for this important legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. The next person I have on my list, and we'll hold the questions till the end, so if you want to stand up, stay around, we can get a specific question. Adam Dunick. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Adam Dunick. I'm here with the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. And today I'm here to testify in support of paid family medical leave and support of this bill. But I do want to draw attention to a couple points related to the construction industry. So the construction industry is very different, especially the unionized construction industry, in terms of how our work occurs, how members go to work each day, and they typically are working themselves out of a job project by project. And so the idea of leaving a job and then being able to go back to one can sometimes be a challenge, and one that we want to continue to work on, how to best craft the policy to fit the construction industry. When paid family medical leave were passed through the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis, we actually asked the cities to exempt our workforce, our members, from the policy because there's so much interaction between workforce that worked in the city but worked in other communities. But seeing a statewide policy move forward is something our members do support. In the last couple of contract negotiations, our members have strongly voiced a need and an urgency around paid family leave. For a lot of different reasons. I think one, the world changed a lot during COVID. Our members were asked to go to work in tough times and sometimes then asked to stay home if they were sick, and so navigating that was a challenge for them. We also have seen some significant mental health challenges in the construction industry of late. If people have been following that, if you are working in construction, you are 4 or 5 times more likely to commit suicide or have challenges around mental health than most industries. Lastly, I just want to say a word about how we're different in construction. The retaliation is a real threat for our members as well. So if you take time off today, you don't always get a job to go back to. And so we just want to make sure that, again, that how this is written impacts those our members in a fair way. And then I'll talk quickly about independent contractors. Independent contractors currently have the option to be exempt. That it also presents a challenge for construction. There's a lot of sham contractors and LLCs that misclassify the workers as independent contractors. If they are not required to pay into a paid family medical leave program, they'll actually have a bidding advantage and a competitive advantage over businesses that do the right thing. And it's another thing on top of workers' compensation, unemployment insurance, and other taxes that legitimate businesses pay. So we just want to take a look at some of those issues. I really want to thank Representative Richardson for her work on this and working with us, and look forward to engaging this community and others in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Dunnick.
Thank you.
Next person on my list is John Reynolds. And after that, get teed up, Tess Schlicksup. Hope I said that properly. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and members. I'm John Reynolds, the Minnesota Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. NFIB opposes HF2 in its current form. The proposal is an outlier in many ways among states that have a paid family and medical leave program, particularly in its treatment of small employers. We believe this will be one of the most expensive programs for small businesses in the country. First, the program's payroll tax amounts to about $1 billion a year to start, with a high weekly benefit payment formula and a combined 24-week leave duration. We believe the cost will rise quickly, perhaps even double in the first few years like Washington's. Second, most states with similarly structured programs allow small employers to opt out of the employer share of the premium while still allowing the employee to access the program. This includes the majority of the states where employer and employee split the cost of the premium: Colorado, Massachusetts, Maryland, Oregon, and Washington. In addition, Delaware exempts very small and seasonal employers from the program entirely. This opt-out offsets the higher administrative burden borne by small employers that do not have layers of management to aid in compliance and are generally starting further away from the requirements of this bill compared to larger competitors. Third, several states also offer 12 weeks of medical and 12 weeks of family leave. However, many cap total yearly leave at 12 weeks plus additional time for circumstances like complications related to childbirth. The total combined leave and weekly benefit formula matter quite a bit in figuring out how much this program will actually cost. If experience is closer to Washington or Massachusetts than last year's fiscal note assumptions, the payroll tax could easily rise to 1.5% or more. Lastly, we are concerned by the lack of balance in eligibility proceedings and appeals and the absence of any ongoing eligibility verification requirements for workers on long-term leave. We urge the committee to protect Main Street employers, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. Tess. And I'm not going to attempt the last name again. After that, we have David Benowitz. If you want to get ready, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Tess Schlicksup, and I'm a registered nurse. I've been working at M Health Fairview Southdale Hospital for the last 9 years, and I care for critical cardiac patients who need support once they discharge home. Daily, I see the effects of a lack of paid family leave in our community because family members need to work. Elderly patients are unable to get adequate support at home and are forced to recover at transitional care facilities. The placement times can take days to weeks at best, lengthening their hospital stay and tying up beds for people who have really acute needs. This further exacerbates issues with staffing in our hospitals as hospital management continues to understaff units, leaving nurses struggling to keep up and ensure patients' needs are met. I've also seen caregivers of patients with chronic disabilities and illnesses come in to visit their family members looking completely exhausted without the resources to cope. Their loved one's hospitalization requires them to take unpaid time off, so they are stressed about catching up on bills, the impact on their employment, and their financial stability. I know all too well the pitfalls of not maintaining your mental health as a caregiver. The eventual result is complete exhaustion, burnout, and exacerbation of acute illnesses, resulting in people needing to take a leave from the workforce to handle their own health needs. It's vital to ensure that people in our workforce can maintain their own health and wellness while also being able to balance their needs, the needs of their loved ones, without worrying about losing their employment or having time off. I have two daughters, and in planning for their births, I had to save up for many years of my vacation time, a majority of my sick time, and to utilize the short-term disability benefit that I've been paying for the last 7 years. I was privileged to be able to take an additional month off of work, but spent over $3,000 for 1 month of COBRA health insurance to cover my family. I know this is not an option for most Minnesotans and most families. Just trying to figure out if I had worked enough hours to take FMLA or how my two-income family would piece together a second income for my sick, vacation, and short-term disability was a significant burden. Most people have access to far, far fewer resources than I do, and it was still incredibly challenging for me. I urge you to support HF2, the Paid Family Leave Act, to better protect our workforce and provide relief to our patients, health and healthcare workers who are leaving their jobs in droves. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. David Benowitz, and next I have Paula Soderberg after that. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, committee members. My name is David Benowitz, and I am the president and co-owner of Craft & Crew Hospitality, which owns and operates five restaurants across the Twin Cities and one in Hastings. Some of you may know, like The Block in St. Louis Park and Stanley's in Northeast Minneapolis. At Craft & Crew, we really focus on building a strong team culture and aim to offer the best possible benefits for our employees. The challenge of a one-size-fits-all paid medical family leave mandate on employers like us is that it would unweave parts of the strong culture we've built, in addition to being administratively challenging to implement. We have nearly 400 employees across our locations, and we have worked extremely hard to foster a culture where we have a positive environment and reduced turnover. While I believe this bill is well-intended, the unfortunate reality as written is that it's very challenging for hospitality businesses to implement these proposed policies. For an example, the logistics of overstaffing to accommodate the proposed 24-week leave benefits would put significant stress and burden on our employees, while in some industries it might be possible to hire a temp to fill a role or to have individuals take on extra work. In our restaurants and kitchens, the skills needed are very specific, and the labor market is extremely tight and will be for the unforeseeable future, or for the foreseeable future. Restaurants are in a fragile state of recovery from the pandemic, and the hospitality industry is still experiencing a shortage of nearly 15,000 workers. It'll be very challenging for us not only to fill the open roles for individuals on leave, but to guarantee their shifts back to them. Additionally, I ask you to consider putting a place on a cap on annual premium increases. Our industry as a whole has taken on a significant amount of debt during the pandemic, and according to a recent survey, 66% of restaurants in Minnesota took an average of $550,000. In debt. The average profit margin of a restaurant like Craft & Crew is roughly 3 to 5% per year. And this new bill proposed would cost our company, as it states right now, approximately $50,000 per year, which is a significant new burden and comes at a very difficult time in our industry. Respectfully, I ask you to slow down and take the time to consider how this would this well-intentioned bill would impact businesses in ways that are not healthy for owners and employees alike. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Benowitz. Paula Soderberg, and then the next person I have is Annika Larson. If you get ready. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members. My name is Paula Soderberg, and I am the Vice President of Human Resources for Morrissey Hospitality, which owns and operates 26 restaurants, hotels, and venues in Minnesota, like the St. Paul Hotel, Bunker Hills Event Center, Water Street Inn, and the Freight House in Stillwater. At Morrissey Hospitality, we take pride in building authentic relationships with our over 900 employees. As we emerged from the pandemic, we made sure that we were providing the best benefits and flexibility we could to all of our employees. We recently implemented an unlimited PTO pilot program so our employees can take the rest and time away from work that they need with their families. Unfortunately, as drafted, HF2 would put a significant strain on our operations and our employees. Our businesses have learned to operate under FMLA standards, but this bill is much more complex and expansive than FMLA. First of all, employee eligibility after 90 days is significantly shorter than FMLA's 1 year and 1,250 hours worked requirement. At 90 days, many of our employees are still learning the skills required for their role and integrating into their teams. To allow them to be removed from that team so soon after being hired poses challenges for teams' functions, as well as to us to find replacements in an industry where we already have an extraordinarily tight labor market. Second, the 24-week total eligibility for these benefits is not workable for our company, as this would put a significant operational burden on the teams at our locations. Finally, the list of eligible family members is very expansive and is not aligned with current FMLA laws. This will cause confusion and should be reevaluated to match federal law. It's important to note that that premium cost will need to be shared with employees, and we are concerned that this will have the opposite effect on employee morale and retention than what is intended by this legislation. Today, I ask that you consider the impact the bill will have on employers and the employee experience. Consideration should be made towards employee eligibility, aligning both the weeks of leave and family definitions to match FMLA. Thank you.
Annika Larson, and next I have Lauren Schotthorst. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Annika Larson. I'm a member of the St. Paul Federation of Educators, and I'm a teacher at Wellstone Elementary. Any job in education is challenging, and even more so when you're becoming a parent. Among my colleagues, we even have to joke about how well we time the due dates of our pregnancies because we have no paid family leave. May or June is perfect. The start of the school year, not so much. My son finally arrived in late August of 2019, which meant that those first crucial months, doctor's appointments, learning to breastfeed, sleepless nights, getting mastitis, all that was happening during the school year when I would otherwise have been earning money. Once I was back at work, lugging my breast pump and my cooler around each day, my unpaid leave was still affecting our income, since deductions that were normally spread across the school year had to come out of 6 months of work. Rather than feeling welcomed back into my career, I was scrambling to rebuild our finances after so much unpaid time. And my husband is also a teacher, and bonding with our baby was important for him as well. So when I returned to work, he took his leave, also unpaid, meaning we lived on one income for the first 6 months of our son's life. Our family is very fortunate, and we had relatives supporting us, and we still felt the pressure of lost income. A huge proportion of educators, especially many of our Black and Brown colleagues, can't rely on money from family. For far too many people, the option to take unpaid leave is just a path to financial disaster. It's painful that anyone would propose withholding care from the educators who are caring for our children, so I want to specifically thank Senator Mann for making sure the bill includes us. If we want to keep educators in this profession and increase teacher diversity in Minnesota, we have to make this job sustainable. We know the first year of a child's life is essential to their development, and we should do everything we can to make sure all of our neighbors and our friends and our educators spend that crucial time with their babies. Paid family leave will give more Minnesota children the safe and stable start to life that they deserve. Again, thank you to the committee and to the chair for letting me share my story.
Thank you. Lauren Schotthorst, the next I have is Kim Lewis.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Schotthorst, and I'm the Director of Workplace Management Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, which represents more than 6,300 businesses and 500,000 employees, testifying in opposition to House File 2 as drafted. I say this on behalf of an organization where over 80% of our members offer paid leave in some form already. The business community is keenly aware of and also acutely impacted by not only the underlying set of issues we're discussing, but the policy proposals related to them. And that is why our members are telling us House File 2 doesn't work for them, especially our small businesses, who do not need or want this benefit to compete. It is too expensive, and it is government-defined, and is actually disruptive and punitive. Here's why. The bill creates a mechanism for an employee to be away from their job for possibly up to 24 weeks each year. That's a considerable new standard. Not every employee will take the entire time off, but despite what you've heard earlier, experience shows that more time will be taken. And the bill, as drafted, almost guarantees more time off will be taken, especially when considering the totality of the proposal compared to other state experiences, the definition of a family member, the expanded list of qualifying events, the enhanced wage replacement rate, the stackability of the leaves in combination with the 80 hours of mandated sick and safe time also moving for the legislature. This makes Minnesota an outlier, and our members are rightfully concerned. We also have a well-documented workforce shortage, and it's expected to get worse in the upcoming decade. In certain workplaces, such as hospitals and manufacturing facilities that run 24/7, or in daycares or schools where staffing ratios are carefully calibrated and monitored, we already do not have enough workers to fill in. Having such a specific and extended leave mandate will disrupt existing benefit packages and unintentionally exacerbate our workforce challenges. Minnesota already imposes a higher cost of doing business than many other states. We often hear from proponents that the other states have done this, and it's not expensive or a big deal for business. We disagree and are highly critical of imposing a new payroll tax on every employer that will collectively cost nearly $1 billion annually to create a broad new state-run insurance program that takes over an existing market and thwarts an emerging one. On that, we are extremely concerned that an outside actuarial analysis has been conducted. We don't even have a fiscal note yet. Based on preliminary review, without modifications to initial scope and design, we do expect the program to run into solvency issues. As we have seen, the payroll tax set forth in this bill has already increased from 0.6 to 0.7%, and the bill does not cap this payroll tax. Businesses can't adequately prepare for this type of uncertainty and tax liability, as we recently saw with the UI Trust Fund solvency crisis. This is a big, complex proposal. We have significant concerns with the way it is drafted and structured in terms of workability. Increased costs further limit resource available for employee compensation, job growth, and expansion. In its current form, House File 2 would impede Minnesota's competitiveness and economic growth. But there are different approaches, and we encourage you all to keep working with stakeholders to find a better, more targeted, and sustainable solution and address issues relating to its cost, its size and scope, its solvency, and the workability of its construction. We appreciate the opportunity to share our opposition and concerns with the committee, and would just like to point out to the handout submitted on behalf of the United for Jobs Coalition on 80 statewide organizations also in opposition. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Kim Lewis. Next, I have Ross Widmauer. Welcome to the committee, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Kimberly Dunn-Lewis, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. Today, I'm also speaking on behalf of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, both principals associations, so elementary and secondary, the Minnesota Rural Education Association, and Schools for Equity in Education. There's a lot of acronyms in there that I hope I spared you. We appreciate the opportunity to share our thoughts on House File 2. We have met with the author in the House and the Senate, and we appreciate their time. Conceptually, we agree with the bill. However, as we continue to learn more about this bill, our school boards, administration, and school human resource representatives have questions in three main areas as they relate to implementation, cost and long-term operation, and other impacts on our district. The primary concern is cost to our schools. I have been before the chair once before a few years ago, and our primary concern is still the cost. We are not able to levy for this cost, so therefore it has to come out of our general fund. That means our classrooms. The other question is how this would be implemented and interact with collective bargaining. If passed, would this statewide benefit supersede our existing contract negotiations, or how would that all work together? It's important to note that our collective bargaining process works well and has done for years, and it provides excellent benefits to many groups of individuals. We're often very sought employer for our time off, our benefits, pensions, et cetera. Finally, due to the nature of the workforce within the schools, there most likely will be a greater need for substitutes, both teachers and staff, which is an added cost as well. Districts today are struggling with hiring and retaining teachers and substitutes. A recent state report issued by Pelsby showed 90% of districts find it difficult or extremely difficult to find teachers and subs. We want members to know a quality education, positive student outcomes, and learning recovery depends on maintaining consistency and continuity in our classrooms and having highly qualified teachers in our classrooms. These are key components to doing our job, educating students. To the operational challenges, we have 9-month employees. Our students are in school approximately 33 weeks. Teachers or staff could be out of our classrooms for 12 or perhaps 24 weeks. That will impact learning. We plan to continue discussions with the author and hope to discuss things such as authorizing employers to require a partial buy down of accrued leave and clarifying language regarding the employee chargeback to delineate that employees are responsible for 50% of the premium costs unless an employer opts to pay more. Finally, as indicated by the number of organizations that I'm speaking on behalf of today, there's a strong interest in this bill. We would respectfully suggest this bill make a stop in the education committees to further discuss the impacts on schools. We appreciate the committee's time in listening to our concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Ross Widmower?
Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, he couldn't be here today, but I've got a letter from him, if I could read that.
Is it in the packet already, or is it?
It didn't make it in time. He didn't know he couldn't be here till last minute. I apologize.
Go ahead, Representative Daniels.
Thank you. I appreciate the lenience there. So Ross Widmower sent us a letter. Greeting committee members. My name is Ross Widmower, and I'm president and CEO of Faribault Mill, a small business in South Central Minnesota that employs more than 100 people. Our company was founded in 1865, and we are the longest standing manufacturer in the state. I'd like to express my opposition to House File 2. As an employer that created new jobs in Minnesota, we've doubled our employment since the pandemic, and I'm keenly aware of concerns on my team members have regarding unexpected emergencies related to personal or family illness. To that end, our company has voluntarily enhanced employee benefits the past 3 years, including increased hourly wages, generous and extended paid time off and of accruals, affordable health insurance, as well as short-time and long-term disability insurance, and a supplemental paid time off for a family emergency. We've done this voluntarily to recruit and retain a talented workforce in the hyper-competitive labor market. We've also done this because it's the right thing to do for our employees. The proposed mandate in House File 2 creates excessive and unnecessary burdens for small business in our state, as well as other tax burdens on employers and employees alike. Small business, like mine, typically have a single point of failure across the many steps of our manufacturing process, meaning one subject matter of an expert leaves for an extended period of time, our production line slows or potentially stops altogether. If an employee were to take paid leave for the extended periods of time allowed under this bill, up to 24 weeks, and as an employer, we are required to hold their position at that same time, our manufacturing could stall or stop for weeks or months. Moreover, the finding and property training or suitable replacement would be incredibly difficult in the current labor shortage in Minnesota. In summary, the mandate proposes unnecessary, excessive, and represents a potential harm to employees and employers alike, especially small business. Many thanks for your service to our state as you continue to consider this legislation and the impact it has on small business in Minnesota. Sincerely, Ross Widmower, President and CEO of Faribault Mills.
Thank you, Representative Daniels. Can you give that letter to the page, and then we can get some copies made for the whole committee and for the audience, too. Thank you. Corey Anderson?
Mr. Chair and members.
And one second. Gavin Hansen's the next one on the list. So go ahead, Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Corey Anderson, and I'm here representing NAFA, National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, and MAHU, Minnesota's Association of Health Underwriters, two organizations with more than 1,000 advisors here in Minnesota. I'm the owner and founder of DI Geek Insurance Agency, specializing in disability insurance, and I've been in the business over 20 years, and I have 4 employees. Through the years, we have worked with over 1,200 clients, protecting the income of business owners and their employees, both hourly and salaried. I'm a frequent featured speaker at industry-related meetings and teaching continuing education on this topic. I, along with MAHU and NAFA, are opposed to House File 2. As a specialist in this area, I can tell you that the private sector has affordable short-term disability products available with very broad coverage for just about every group and individual. The market is competitive with many providers offering coverage for disability income, so the prices are very affordable. To the extent that the advocates of the bill have run into problems finding coverage, they may need to talk to another agent that has more expertise in these lines of business, because affordable solutions are available. The perception of a scarcity is not an accurate representation of our marketplace. What this bill does is put the state government in direct competition with the private sector, both insurance carriers and insurance agents. This bill will be a virtual market takeover by a state agency who has no experience delivering services in this area or accurately pricing such a product. Most employers currently offer either subsidized short-term disability coverage to their employees or voluntary unsubsidized coverage, where the employee has the option to purchase coverage. To the extent that the employee has not opted for coverage, they're making a value decision on what works best for their current needs. We recommend the following. One, leave the private sector to serve the market for short-term disability or medical leave, as it is called in this bill, and provide incentives for employers to provide that coverage to their employees. Mandate those employers with over 50 employees offer short-term disability coverage with tax incentives to do so, and outline the flexible minimum coverage requirements. Number two, let the state concentrate on family leave coverage, since there is not a well-developed private market that will be displaced. My clients and the public are not interested in another unfunded mandate that creates a $1 billion payroll tax on businesses and their employees. The public like the idea of coverage. They don't like the idea of another tax shrinking their paycheck check in a time of high inflation with the economy moving towards a likely recession. Please vote no. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Gavin Hansen. And the last person I have on my list is Alex Hassel. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair, staff, and members of the committee. My name is Gavin Hansen, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Business Partnership, which represents many of Minnesota's largest employers. Let me first say that the members of the Minnesota Business Partnership support paid leave policies. We support them because it is the right thing to do for our employees and their families. In today's ultra-competitive workforce, providing paid leave is essential for attracting top talent locally, regionally, and globally. Our membership already provides very generous paid leave benefits to their employees. Many offer a more generous leave than what this bill prescribes. However, the bill before you today would make it extremely difficult for a business who already offers paid leave to offer a qualified employer plan, even if their paid leave benefit program exceeds the minimum requirement that is currently outlined in the bill. These issues include an expansive definition of family, no cap on the 24-plus weeks of leave, and the brief window of 90 days required before eligibility for this program. We are concerned that the paid family medical leave proposal, as currently written, will harm our employees. It would disrupt existing employee benefit plans and force employees into a state-run program offering reduced benefits while facing the added burden of a new payroll tax. Paid family medical leave should be a benefit to the employee. And from an employee standpoint, having to contact a bureaucrat in a state agency to answer questions and access paid leave benefits instead of being able to contact the trusted human resources person where you work is burdensome and unfair to the employee. We respectfully ask the committee to consider that a benefit program like paid leave should be as easy as possible to administer and shouldn't punish employees who already receive comparable benefits at their companies. We are prepared to work with you to find a path that helps expand PFML benefits to employees who don't have access to PFML without harming the many employees who already do. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Alex Hassel. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alex Hassel. I'm here on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm also speaking today on behalf of my colleague, Matt Hilgart, with the Association of Minnesota Counties. He was called to testify in another committee. So I'm combining testimony for both cities and counties. As public employers, we recognize that our number one asset is our workforce. Together, we employ tens of thousands of employees across the state who work to deliver essential public services to their communities. We understand the importance of supporting that workforce, and through a long history of collective bargaining, cities and counties provide public sector employees generous benefits. Many of these CBAs offer significant plans surrounding paid time off, sick leave, short-term disability, and more. I mention these benefits because in many cases they aim to provide a similar benefit as this bill, but due to the rigidity of the program would not meet the requirements of the program. Many cities and counties offer accrued leave of over 1,000 hours to be used for an employee's needs. For context, 1,000 hours of leave is 25 weeks. These leave banks provide full salary replacement and in some cases can be paid out upon retirement. We would like to see this bill authorize an employer to require the use of some of this time as it was intended to be used for these leave purposes. Under the current proposal, an employee could utilize up to 24 weeks of leave and still have access to their entire leave bank. Not only is this a large financial liability for public employers to continue to carry, but it isn't using accrued leave for its intended purpose. For a few examples, we have cities like Alexandria and Perham who offer up to 24 weeks worth of accrued leave time. We also have cities like New Ulm that offers up to 1,600 hours of accrued leave. These are just a few examples, but many cities and counties of all sizes across the state provide these types of benefits. We would also like to see the bill specify that future premium adjustments be noticed to employers before preliminary levies are set. It is imperative that any increased costs from this program be communicated before preliminary levies are set to ensure that local governments can account for increased costs and that this does not result in service reductions or impacts to operations. For the sake of time, I'll leave it at that, but we do hope that future iterations of this bill can recognize some of the unique circumstances and benefits provided by public employers. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Before we go to amendments, are there anybody else that needs to speak on this bill? Something we haven't done the last couple of years with COVID. With that, members, I've got amendments. Representative Daniels, you're the first one I've got on my list, House or A15 amendment. You want to explain what your amendment does?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little bit of a background on the Senate side. This amendment was accepted by Senator Pappas. Just give you that. This provides job creators, six-month delay in the amendment, simply provides job creators, especially the smaller ones, with more time to prepare for the impacts of this far-outreaching bill. It allows the job creators to get through the summer seasonal and holiday work before the bill would kick in. Just allows them to get ready to adapt to what's going on. It's a pretty small ask in this amendment just to delay everything 6 months to give everybody in the job market a chance to adjust. And you heard by the testifiers today, the majority of the testifiers were against this bill in the form it's in now. They'd be willing to work, you know, with the bill author. But just asking that for the amendment that we could delay it 6 months to give people more time to get adjusted.
And you're moving that amendment?
I would like to move that amendment, Mr. Chair. Yes,
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Daniels, for the amendment. At this time, there are a lot of discussions happening with BEAD around the timeline. So I would respectfully ask members for a no vote on this amendment. They're definitely open to future conversation, but right now I'd ask for a no vote.
Questions, members?
Can I request a roll call, please?
Roll call has been requested. We'll have a roll call.
Chair Nelson?
No.
Nelson, nay. Vice Chair Berg?
No.
Berg, nay. Lead McDonald?
Yes.
McDonald, aye. Representative Daniels?
Aye.
Daniels, aye. Representative Greenman?
No.
Greenman, nay. Representative Hill?
No.
Hill, nay. Representative Hussein?
No.
Hussein, nay. Representative Jordan?
No.
Jordan, nay. Representative Koslowski?
No.
Koslowski, nay. Representative Meckland?
Aye.
Meckland, aye. Representative Myers?
Aye.
Myers, aye. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott?
Aye.
Wolgamott, aye. Mr. Chair, at the conclusion of roll call, there are 6 ayes and 7 nays.
With the vote of 6 ayes and 7 nays, the amendment is not adopted. The next amendment I have is the A-17, and Representative Myers, is that your amendment?
It is.
You want to move your amendment?
Yes, I'd like to move the A-17 amendment. Mr. Chair, thank you, Rep. Richardson, for bringing this bill before us. We've heard before in the past about, trying to balance out the requirements for both job creators and employees. And so what this amendment does is just helping to ensure that compliance by also providing those disclosures to employees. And we've heard from other bills that we've heard that the agencies are willing to, draft these documents so that there can be consistency. So this amendment would mean that each employer must post a conspicuous place on each of its premises, a uniform workplace notice prepared by the department providing notice of benefits available under this chapter. The uniform workplace notice prepared by the department must be in English and each of the primary languages in Minnesota. I'm hoping that, we can all agree on this amendment because we've seen it in other bills where we're asking job creators to provide additional transparency and documentation. And I think this is really going to go to help both parties involved. And I look at this from, small business owners that maybe don't have some of the access, because there isn't a limit on how many, employees you can have to, have to follow this. And so I'm hoping that the agency with the potential resources, 300 employees that they're going to have, that they could provide that to the job creator so that they can post it. So, it just gives a little bit of consistency because I don't think the agencies want to give out fines for this, and I think it's just a small way to, balance it out. So I would hope that the author would be willing to accept this amendment.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Myers, for the amendment. I agree with you that there is likely some work here that could be done to ensure that it's the department that is preparing the documents that would be posted. In its current form, I would ask for folks to vote no, and just understanding that right now in Minnesota, if we look at the primary languages that are spoken, based on MDE records, there are more than 300 languages that are spoken across the state. And the real intent of this is to ensure that the languages that are spoken within the business, those are the flyers that would be posted. And I think we should also note that not all primary languages are in writing either. So just ensuring that the intent is followed, that when individuals are working in a space, that that languages are reflected. Happy to work with you around language that could make it clear that it would be a uniform notice that deed would provide. But in terms of requiring every business to post 300 primary language placards isn't necessary unless there's 300 languages that are going to be spoken within that space.
Representative Berg, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question for Representative Myers. Actually, the author just talked a lot about how many actual languages there are, how many may be spoken in any given business. Certainly thinking about our warehouses where there are a large amount of folks from varying backgrounds. What was sort of the intent behind the amendment to just sort of qualifying it as the primary languages in Minnesota? Just curious.
Representative Myers. Thank you. Representative Berg, thank you for that question. The reason we are doing this is we see standard notices provided for the Department of Labor and OSHA at certain organizations. And, as was pointed out, there are, 300 languages. So now we have some small business owners that may have to post that many languages. What I was trying to get to was that the department who, based on some of the information was going to have, or the agency was going to have 300 employees, it'd be much easier
for them to come up with that required notice that you would put out there that you'd see in your businesses to help that, because again, you know, there is fines related to some of the stuff, and I think working with the job creators to provide those disclosures to employees would be helpful.
Representative Burr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. May I ask the author a question?
Representative Berg.
Thank you. In this bill, would each employer be required to post something in all 300 languages?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you for the question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the way that the bill is currently drafted, the top five languages that would be spoken within a space would be required to be posted. There are policies that are currently in place around limited English proficiency, so that could look different if someone, for example, you know, gets federal funding. But the intent around these placards are to ensure that people with limited English proficiency know the rules, and so that, you know, to the point of ensuring that it's the department that is preparing a uniform notice. No concerns with that at all, but I just don't want to all of a sudden create a requirement that will be unwieldy for everyone.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Richardson, I mean, is there an amendment that you would offer so that we can get to the point where, again, I think the resources or the lack of HR for some of these really small businesses that you would agree to at a future date that we could work on?
Representative Richardson.
Or an amendment to this amendment.
I would definitely be open to striking the approved language, which would take out sort of the idea that a business could submit something different than what would be related to the uniform DALI related documentation that would go forward. In terms of doing amendments on the fly, I will defer to the chair of the committee.
Representative Richardson and Representative Myers, I think that's a little beyond what I would feel comfortable doing on the fly here. But again, this has many future stops. If you want to, Representative Myers, if you want to work with the author of the bill and try and come up with language that she would be acceptable with and work with the attorneys that are up in our revisor's office to get the language right. I'm afraid if we do something on the fly, we may screw it up here, and I don't want to do that. Representative Myers.
Thank you. How many more stops does this have?
I'm not sure. It's going to State Gov Finance after here. Representative Richardson, do you know how many more stops you have?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Several. After State Gov, Commerce, Human Services, and that's what I have at the top of mind right now.
Taxes in my whisper.
Oh, yeah, taxes. Thank you for reminding me.
Quite a few. So Representative Richardson. Or Representative Myers, I mean.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, I want to make the, you know, commitment to meet with you, and hopefully that would, you know, you'd be willing to do the same so that we could, you know, address this outside of here and hopefully have, you know, a change that we can agree on.
Thank you. Happy to do that.
So,
and I'll withdraw my amendment then.
Representative Myers withdraws the A-17 amendment. The next amendment I have here is the A-18. Is that yours, Representative McDonald?
It is, Mr. Chair.
You want to explain? You want to move your amendment?
I'd like to move my the A-18.
And you want to explain it?
Yes, the A-18 would just request the Office of Legislative Auditor to do an audit in January of 2026. That's 1 year from the program, the implementation of the program. I think I would hope, Representative Richardson, you would see this as a friendly amendment, and I'm sure that you, like the rest of us legislators, rely on the Office of Legislative Auditor for some very important data that they do. They've audited many programs in the past and found some deficiencies in areas that we can make things better, especially when we do a bill quickly and put it through the legislative process with few amendments from the other side. So, very friendly amendment. I think with a $1.7 billion seed money to start the program and a $1 billion tax increase per year, I think it would only be very beneficial that we do an audit at least a year after your program to see how this is working and if it's doing the exact the intent that you want it to do, and to make sure that we're fiscally responsible for the taxpayers, businesses, employees, and employers.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just note that this amendment would only be 6 months into the proposed program. It wouldn't be a year into the program. I recognize that the OLA, you know, can always do a review of the program. The question that I would have is around the timing piece, you know, versus 6 months to a year. In its current form, I would recommend a no vote on the amendment.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, would you author and accept a oral amendment to change it to July 1st of 2026?
Representative Richardson, what's your pleasure with of that before we?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy to take this conversation offline to work on a potential amendment for a future stop.
Representative McDonald, do you want to modify your amendment is what I'm hear you say here?
Yeah, I would like to have you accept or vote on oral amendment to change it to July 1st of 2026. Representative Richardson, I just soon do this online so we can get it done today. You know how this process works. We get on to the next bill, the next committee, and meetings don't necessarily get set up. It's a very simple correction or amendment. And for that, I ask your indulgences and accept it.
So Representative McDonald's modifying his amendment. And I don't believe we need to have a vote on that. He's modifying his amendment to change on line 1.4, strike January and insert July. And Ms. Shonlin, that you got that? And so the amendment now reads, July 1st of 2026, that the legislative auditor required to do an audit. Does everybody here understand that? There's questions of the amendment. If not.
Do we need to vote on this, Mr. Chair?
We'll need to vote on the amendment, yes.
Not
we don't need to vote on the.
Correct.
You're modifying your own amendment.
Correct. Correct.
So, conversation on the amendment. Questions on the amendment. Representative. Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to raise some concerns about this. As a new member of the Legislative Audit Commission, there's an entire process for the way that we select a way that the Legislative Audit and the issues that they're going to select. It's a bipartisan process with three members from each of the bodies. And so I think that if this becomes something that the bodies want to take up, I think we should go through the Legislative Audit Commission. I know that there's a strong preference to not directly direct the audit. So I express concerns, and I'd urge our members to vote no.
Representative Jordan, do you have your hand up also? Or?
No, Mr. Chair. I agree with Representative Greenman, and I was concerned about the way this amendment was drafted. I think it needs further evaluation, and I will be a no on this amendment.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, after being here 13 years, this is exactly what we should be doing and not waiting for yet another couple, three, 4 years. I've been here for MNLARS and MNsure, and now recently we had the Feed Your Starving Children. This would be the very fiscal responsible to do to put this in the bill today, or at least a placeholder, Representative Richardson. There's, as you said, there's many more stops. You certainly can take it off, but you could do the right thing. Frankly, because of the size and scope of the bill and the history of the state that we do make mistakes, I wish we weren't all human. Maybe someday in the clone IT universe or AI universe, we won't make mistakes, but there's going to be mistakes with this bill. There's bills that I voted for 10 years ago that we made mistakes, that we have to have the OLA do a report. That's just human nature. But this bill, certainly this small little amendment that doesn't cost anything, is a good placeholder, Representative Richardson, just to ensure that in 1 year from the date of your bill that is very important to you, that we do an audit to make sure it's doing exactly what you want it to do. It's a good safeguard. And it's cheap insurance, zero premiums.
Representative Richardson, again, what is your pleasure with the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As stated previously, happy to continue conversations on this, recognizing that there are members of the that are serving on that committee here as well. Just want to ensure that, to your point, that we are not doing these amendments on the fly and actually have the conversations that we need to have. But very open to continuing those conversations outside of committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, Representative.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Don.
Yeah, Representative Richardson, I hope you do consider this offline or another stop as well. It certainly is a very sincere amendment. It wasn't a getcha amendment. But with that, I do ask for a roll call.
Roll call is being asked for. We'll have a roll call. Mr. Bauman.
Chair Nelson.
No.
Nelson, nay. Vice Chair Berg?
No.
Berg, nay. Lead McDonald?
Yes.
McDonald, aye. Representative Daniels?
Aye.
Daniels, aye. Representative Greenman?
No.
Greenman, nay. Representative Hill?
No.
Hill, nay. Representative Hussein?
No.
Hussein, nay. Representative Jordan?
No.
Jordan, nay. Representative Koslowski?
No.
Koslowski, nay. Representative Meckland?
Aye.
Meckland, aye. Representative Myers?
Aye.
Myers, aye. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott?
Aye.
Wolgamott, aye. Mr. Chair, at the conclusion of roll call, there are six ayes and seven nays.
With six ayes and seven nays, the amendment is not adopted. I have two more amendments here. The A20 amendment. And Representative Schultz, is that your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I move the A20 amendment.
Representative Schultz moves the A20 amendment. You want to explain what this one does?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In general, as we look at the A20 amendment, this provides some guidance here that we actually get the actuarial analysis for this bill. So as this is going to impact job creators and the workers and employers across the state, it's important that we have the data, have the information, as has been mentioned during the course of the testimony here today. Without accurate fiscal information being provided by a third party, we're going to struggle to implement this program. And so I'd really encourage us to do this. Colorado, Maine, Washington State, and others have also done this. And with the amount of employees and supporters of this bill that need to be hired, and with the intricacies of the network systems and the division at Deed that you want to create with this bill, one would think that we want to fully know the impact of this bill on Minnesotans and especially our job creators. So, and I'm going to reference back specifically to what the Commissioner Blisenbach said, saying data and information is extremely important to the installation of this. That was in her testimony, and she made that mention, and that's why I'd really like to see this amendment adopted. So once again, I move the A20 amendment.
The A20 amendment has been moved. Representative Richardson, what is your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz, for bringing the amendment forward. I think it's really important to note that I'm not opposed to an actuarial analysis. We do have an opportunity here in Minnesota to learn from other states that have implemented their programs. And from what we've seen, some states have started with very low premiums, and they're now adjusting. The data that we have used is based on cost modeling from the U.S. Department of Labor, and there is nothing in the bill that prevents us from doing an actuarial study, and I'm even fine requiring that actuarial study, but I don't think it should be done at the expense of delaying benefits for Minnesotans who are being impacted and having their financial security impacted, especially in light of the fact that the bill in its current form is shoring up the fund with $1.7 billion from the surplus. So while I'm open to adding an amendment on an actuarial analysis on the next step, as long as it wouldn't be something that would delay the implementation of the program. But in the current form, I'd recommend a no vote, Mr. Chair.
Representative Myers.
Schultz.
Schultz, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Richardson.
I'm terrible with names, and I'm two new members that I'm looking here. And
hey, you're doing great. You're doing great. appreciate that you share the passion around this issue, and I think that this is a great opportunity to adopt this right now. You just mentioned the support for the principle, for the idea, and this amendment does that. And so let's follow the science, the data, the information. Let's add this to this bill. If you believe that it needs to be changed further, you mentioned there are other committee stops, but this is a great way to ensure that we're getting the data that we need. Again, following in the footsteps of other states who have taken this action. Colorado, Maine, and Washington have done this. So I encourage support for this amendment, and I'd ask for a roll call.
Roll call is being asked for. There'll be a roll call. Any other questions or comments from members? If not, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
No.
Nelson, nay. Vice Chair Berg?
No.
Berg, nay. Lead McDonald?
Yes.
McDonald, aye. Representative Daniels?
Aye.
Daniels, aye. Representative Greenman?
No.
Greenman, nay. Representative Hill?
No.
Hill, nay. Representative Hussein?
No.
Hussein, nay. Representative Jordan?
No.
Jordan, nay. Representative Kozlowski?
No.
Kozlowski, nay. Representative Meckland?
Aye.
Meckland, aye. Representative Myers?
Aye.
Myers, aye. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott?
No.
Wolgamott, nay. Mr. Chair, with the conclusion of roll call, there are 5 ayes and 8 nays.
With 5 ayes and 8 nays, the amendment is not adopted. And I think this is the last amendment I have, is the A22 amendment. And Representative McDonald, are you going to off? That's whose name I got down here.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A22 amendment.
And do you want to explain what that does, Representative McDonald?
Yes, I do. It reads, in no year shall the annual premium rate exceed 1% of taxable wages paid to each employee. Based upon the other states and the federal paid family leave, they all started out at one tax, but some of them doubled. And many in the industry don't believe that this tax will be sufficient enough to run the whole program. Some other states that have adopted this also had legislation that it would have to come back to the legislature before it increased in its rate. So my amendment just puts it at a cap so it doesn't increase and therefore causing yet more costly premium tax to the employers.
Representative Richardson, what's your pleasure with the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative McDonald, for the amendment. I think it's going to be really important if we are putting in place a cap on the annual premium that it be tied to the data and that we are not just selecting any number. I would just share that there are conversations that are happening right now. There are discussions underway, and I also know, I believe Representative Witte is also someone who is interested in this topic as well, and so I anticipate that there will be continued conversation around a cap, but this in this current form, I would ask for a no vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Representative Richardson, I'm sure you're aware that this amendment was accepted in the Senate bill. So at one point, they'll have to come together. And it just gives some certainty for job creators and for employees, for that matter. This tax will not just be paid by the employers, the job creators. It'll be paid by their team members. 50% of the tax will be passed on to their team members. That's almost a fact, as it was in the last, in the 13 other states that have done this. So it certainly will be a tax increase. Employees will get receive less in their paychecks each week or each month, however they're distributed, 2 weeks usually. And the job certainty for creators, certainly this gives them some kind of a insurance that this tax will at least be capped and not continue to rise and rise and rise. And in lieu of the fact that they did accept this in the Senate, and you're not willing to accept anything in committee, which is where the work should be done, not in an office or behind closed doors or in someone's office as well, as I said that already, the work should be done in committee. So I challenge you and ask you to accept this amendment, a friendly amendment, a wise, fiscal, responsible amendment for all job creators, for their team members, their employees, and the fact that the Senate, usually we don't want to brag about the Senate being the wiser of the two, but in this case, I will agree with them. I think they were wise to take this amendment, and I encourage you to do the same.
Representative McDonald, on the floor, we're not supposed to speak of that lesser body, the lower body.
My apologies.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would add a couple of things to that. As you stated, with the Senate and their bill, there will have to be conversations. So that is exactly right. There will have to be conversations around the cap, and there are conversations that are happening right now. I also want to be really clear that in terms of thinking through the jurisdiction of this committee and understanding that as part of that conversation, it should also include deed, because this is going to be relevant to the work that they are doing as well. And my understanding is that deed is not in the room, and they would be an important part of that conversation that would need to happen.
And Representative Richardson, that is not a committee or a, we don't have purview over them with this committee, so that is handled in a different committee. So Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Richardson, is anyone from deed that would be able to speak to your comment? Are they in the audience?
I don't believe there's anybody here from them, from deed. So Representative McDonald, what's your pleasure?
Well, my pleasure is, of course, Representative Richardson, you would accept this amendment, and all of the committee members would vote in favor of it. This will result in lower wages for employees. That's just the fact. It certainly has been the fact in the other states and also in our St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Duluth that have adopted these. So this gives everyone certainty, especially those who are giving the jobs to those who need them. So with that, I ask you a friendly amendment that you would accept this.
And Representative Richardson, Representative McDonald, do you, as we go to a vote, we've already heard from the author of the bill. It's your amendment. What's your pleasure? Do you want?
Mr. Chair, if we could just vote on it.
Okay.
Voice vote would be acceptable.
That's what I'm getting at. I want to make sure we don't get a roll call.
Right.
So members, all in favor of the A22 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The noes have it.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Wait. Can we do is there
no, an Mr. Chair. The
I think the motion passed, actually. The ayes had it. I didn't hear anyone say nay.
Is my hearing going bad? You know, I worked in construction 40 years, so sometimes my hearing is not good.
What'd you say?
Exactly. Do you want to?
Well, I think the ayes had it. The gavel was struck. So thank you very much, members. I appreciate it.
What?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I ask for division.
Okay, division. Would raise your hands. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? I guess my hearing wasn't as bad as I thought.
Mr. Chair, my eyesight's not very good. I thought the ayes had it.
6-7. So, members, that's the last amendment. Discussion of the bill. Representative Schultz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Richardson for bringing this bill. I heard a number of things from the testimony today, most particularly in the things that concern me are three primary things. The impacts upon mandates, that mandates are a one-size-fits-all approach that negatively impact both employees and employers. And we've heard testimony today from our job creators across Minnesota, and they reference specifically that 80% of businesses already provide this sort of leave, and then the onerous mandate about this just raises taxes for business owners and job creators, including and specifically schools. So I wanted to ask Representative Hill some questions. So Representative Hill, if you'll just provide for me this equation where this legislature is considering a number of things related to our schools. $17.6 billion is a lot of money, but as we heard from the schools today, they mentioned that this can't be levied for, and it would directly impact educational programming in schools. So can you answer for me, what would be the impacts to education programming for you, a teacher, correct, into your schools, and what programs you see would be worthwhile of cutting so that we could implement this?
Sure. Representative Hill, before you answer, we in our discussion here, we don't want to be attacking other members, but Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. I think a couple of things. Number one, I think this makes this profession and others more welcoming, more accessible to more workers, and that's particularly in this moment what we need. And so as far as if we do this, what would you cut? I don't see it that way in my mental model of what this bill will bring for our schools and our districts. I see it in the opposite way, that this would allow for more folks to access that career and move forward in that way.
Representative Schultz. And members, we're going to be voting on this before 2:30, so we go on. I've got one other person on the list so far. So
thank you, Mr. Schultz. Chair. Yeah, that was the concern that they mentioned, right? Cost of schools, they can't levy, and it would directly impact educational programming. So my question to the members of this committee is, you know, with direct impacts to education, you know, are our students going to be better off with this bill? Are our students going to be better off? Are we going to have excellence in education, higher standards because of this bill? Are our students going to be offered greater things? So that's a concern for me in this bill. And then particularly, if I just really want to focus upon the competitiveness. You know, many of us represent districts that border other states or are representing communities that have already implemented ideas like this on the municipal level. And you know, my question for Representative Hill is also, Main Street small business owners in Stillwater have to compete with Hudson and neighboring communities. How do you think that this will impact the Main Street small business owners in Stillwater?
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks again for the question. I recognize that I do come from a border community. I also recognize that there are small businesses that are in favor of this legislation that allows them to get into the game as far as offering this benefit to people who need time off to care for a sick family member or if they themselves fall victim to an illness. And so I understand the question, but I also believe that this benefits our small businesses. Thank you.
Representative, I'm going to go to the next question, and we'll come back around if there's time. We need everybody in the committee a chance. Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. This has been a really great discussion. A lot of thoughtful amendments and questions. I learned some things, so thank you. We heard from a number of different industries. We had healthcare, we had construction folks, and each talking about how specifically their members are impacted, which I thought was fascinating. So I just want to make sure we bring it back around and center the workers when we have this conversation. This is something workers have been asking for. And I think that what I'd like to point out that we didn't hear from was said workers. Because they're working
or not because they've had to take care of a loved one or and have sacrificed their job because of that. So again, you're always going to hear from me centering the workers in these discussions, and I really want to thank the author for continuing to work on this legislation that has been around for a long time that our workers and their families are asking for. So thank you, Chair Richardson.
Any other members have questions? If not, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to competitiveness, it matters for the entire state. We've seen in places like Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, where Representative Kozlowski represents, that they've implemented plans similar to this. And for me, I've literally seen and had the conversations with business owners and job creators and those seeking to literally escape those communities and go to the communities directly surrounding them. And this presents just a blanket. My curiosity is, you know, for Representative Kozlowski, could you explain to us, I was certainly hoping that you'd want this benefit specifically for your city so that you could compete for the workers better than Hermantown, better than Proctor, and better than the surrounding communities.
Representative.
Thank you so much, Chair, and Representative Schultz. I'd be delighted to speak on this. You know, a couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to work with the Women's Foundation of Minnesota, and we actually did a listening tour across the state in rural communities, suburban cities, like the cities in the metro areas. And we heard across the board from workers, from small business owners alike, that this is actually one of the number one things that we could do to secure gender, economic and racial equity. And as I'm sitting here and looking at, you know, the number of businesses in my community who are telling me that as small business owners, that we actually need this to remain competitive as a border community. This is a win-win for employers, for employees and the state. And I can tell you that I've been hearing from small businesses, particularly, you know, as we look at growing women-owned businesses, veteran-owned businesses, queer-owned, BIPOC-owned, that we're actually seeing these businesses fold because they don't have paid family medical leave. And as we heard in this committee from Earn Sick and Safe Time as we passed it out, that it's, you know, two sides of the same coin. And so I'm actually hearing from employers in our area who are hungry to start and grow businesses, expand right in Duluth, right in my region, not going anywhere else, but because they love our community, because they're rooted in our community and want to nourish and pour into, that they're begging for this to be accessible to everybody. So I can go on and on and on, but I actually believe that it is a key element for our competitiveness.
I have one more person, Representative Greenman. You have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to sort of bring us back to, I think, what Representative, what Vice Chair Berg was talking about, because, you know, this, I have heard this bill. We made a lot of stops last year, and this year, the good work. And one of the things that we hear in committee after committee is people's stories about what it means not to have this. And I think we all have a story of that, if you think about it. You know, I will say my story. When I was in law school, my dad was really sick, had multiple myeloma, and my sister and I were down at Mayo, and we got really bad news that he wasn't going to get well again, and he probably had 4 or 5 weeks left, maybe a little longer. And I was in law school in California, and my sister had just become a nurse, and we were sitting on a park bench in Rochester trying to figure out how she could take the time to be with my dad. And it is a devastating time to be thinking about how you're going to count your pennies to take that time. And nobody, you know, we figured it out because Annie, my sister, had unpaid leave, and my dad was able to help, and we sort of put our pennies together, but lots of folks don't have access to that. And this is an opportunity for us to make sure that no family is in that situation. in when they're thinking about pregnancy, when they're thinking about a family member they're losing, and all of everything in between. And so I just want to ground us in the fact that if you talk to your family, if you have your own story, like, we're doing this so that folks don't have to be in that position anymore. And I hope that as we vote on this bill, folks remember that and vote yes.
Representative McDonald, do you want to do a wrap up before we vote?
Sure.
Your side or not, and you can make it quick because
2 minutes. Sure. So currently in state law, or currently in the state, all businesses right now currently can offer this to their employees. So there's no law preventing them from doing that. Federal family leave allows for 12 days. Excuse me, 12 weeks. But most Minnesota workers already have some sort of paid family medical leave. According to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, 80% of their members offer paid family leave. According to the National Federation of Independent Businesses, who have thousands of members, I think I was a member at one point and will probably join again as a small business person, the vast majority of those small business owners offer flexibility for them to pick up their kids at games, for family emergencies. So it's already done. And probably the reason we haven't heard from workers necessarily is because 7% of Minnesotans don't have this at all. Only 7%. And that's from a 2019 analysis by nonpartisan House researchers found that under 200,000 Minnesota workers would benefit from the program. So less than 7%. This is going to be a very, very expensive tax increases to employers and employees. The governor stated at the beginning of the session regarding the $17.5 billion surplus, and I quote, "We will return it, whether it be through tax cuts or direct payments." We haven't seen those yet. "We are committed," I'd presume the majority, "we are committed to lowering costs for our working families, small businesses, and seniors." Well, this bill will do nothing but raise the taxes on small businesses in the state of Minnesota. That's the facts. That's what it's done in the states, the cities that already adopted this, and that's what's done in the 13 states that have implemented this program. Minnesota's program, your bill, Representative Richardson, is going to be the one of the most generous paid family leave in the history of the nation, and very costly to our employers and employees. They will pass the tax down to their employees. There's no doubt. As far as the audit, I wish you would have accepted that, because in the past years, the legislature has built in already OLA reports. We did that House File 1 in 2017, the premium reduction. Remember that, Mr. Chair? So it was not uncommon practice to have that built in to have as a safeguard for making sure that we're protecting the taxpayers' monies. So just in closing, we've heard from hundreds of businessmen and women. We've heard from school boards. We've heard from the police departments. We've heard from school administrators. We've heard from the Chamber of Commerce. We've heard from superintendents. Most of them, a lot of them were here just today expressing their concern of the bill. We had some amendments that were some safeguards, very easy, safe, responsible amendments, and Representative Richardson said you wouldn't take them. This has been to already four committees, and I don't know how many more it has to go to. I hope, Representative Richardson, because if I was in your seat as a lawmaker presenting a bill where I had thousands of people against my bill, I would at least sit down with them and try to make the bill better. Do you know that last week there was over 65 Chamber of Commerces?
Representative Donald, do you want to come to a conclusion?
Yep. I won't read the 65 Chambers of Commerces. My Delano was one of them, of many. In almost every one of your districts, you had Chamber presidents and businessmen here, executive directors here, to speak against the bill. And yet you seem not to have any concern to address their issues to make the bill better or address their our concerns with the bill as well. So I oppose the bill, and I do request a roll call then.
Roll call,
Mr.
Being
Chairman.
Requested, we'll have a roll call. Representative Richardson, if you want to do your quick wrap up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to dispel a couple of things. First, the majority of Minnesotans do not have access to paid family and medical leave. And we need to get that on the record because the majority of Minnesotans do not have access to this. And what we know and what the data tells us is 80% of people across the United States support access to paid family and medical leave. And 78% of small businesses support access to paid family medical leave. And they want a government-run program because we have uneven safety nets that entire families are falling through. And we talk about the cost of doing this bill. We also need to talk about the cost of not doing this bill because that costs our economy millions and millions of dollars a year, from long-term care costs to the cost on for folks being on social programs like MPIP, our maternal health costs, infant mortality costs. And I think it's also really important to recognize that we have folks who have talked about having to leave the rural areas that they love because they can't get access to this benefit. And so I just want it to be on the record and clear that the majority do not. And those who have better programs than what is offered here, they can keep their program. They don't have to participate here. But we shouldn't have people who have access to paid leave preventing other people from getting it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, Mr. Members, I'll renew my motion that House File 2, as amended, be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Vice Chair Berg?
Aye.
Berg, aye. Lead McDonald?
No.
McDonald, nay. Representative Daniels?
No.
Daniels, nay. Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Hill?
Aye.
Hill, aye. Representative Hussein?
Aye.
Hussein, aye. Representative Jordan?
Jordan, aye.
Jordan, aye. Representative Kozlowski?
Kozlowski, aye.
Kozlowski, aye. Representative Meckland?
No.
Meckland, nay. Representative Myers?
Nay.
Myers, nay. Representative Schultz?
Nay.
Schultz, nay. Representative Wolgamott?
Aye.
Wolgamott, aye. Mr. Chair, with the conclusion of roll call, there are 8 ayes and 5 nays.
With 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion is passed, and the bill is on its way to state government finance. Thank you, Representative Richardson. Good luck. And with that, members, no further business before this committee. We are adjourned.